And even satellites can't take photographs inside of buildings, as far as I know. And so you have this time dimension. You have all sorts of blocked information that you might be able to get at that, in fact, we have very strong data showing that you can get at psychically.
Well, you've detailed a lot of it in The Mind Race, this marvelous book that you've written. It's must reading. In fact, I think for a lot of people it has become must reading. How's the book doing?
It's in about a dozen countries and must be getting close to 150,000 copies, somewhere between 100 and 150,000. I've lost count, frankly.
NASA took your research very seriously?
NASA supported a program at SRI to look into whether ordinary people could learn to teach themselves to use psychic abilities with a little ESP teaching machine. And they found that, yes, in fact, nobody got worse, and more people than you would expect by chance got better.
Can I get one of those teaching machines?
Stay tuned.
Stay tuned?
Stay tuned.
We'll talk about it in just a second. Listen carefully.
Jones?
Well, I would like to have my head even higher in some mystic clouds, but only insofar as I keep my feet on the ground.
Well,
I'm very practically oriented, and I like to not be fooled. That's why I think I get into the scientific side of
this. Because people can fool themselves a lot about this stuff. And yet, if you worry too much about that and don't have anything to do with it, you miss the real gems that are available through psychic kind of work and the spiritual work that psychic work can lead on to.
There is sort of an interrelation between the two, isn't there?
All of the great spiritual traditions used psychic phenomena as a justification for their reality. I mean, they all said, I'm not just talking some nice ideas about what the way the world is and the way you ought to live, but see, I can work some miracles to prove that I'm in touch with a higher power. Of course, all the spiritual traditions have all worked the same miracles, each one justifying its particular one, but that really does tell us that there's something solid behind spiritual ideas. And actually, that's why I'm more interested in the implications of psychic phenomena than the applications. And I think the applications are wonderful, and they can become far more practical than they are now as we research them. But the implications for what they say about human nature is really important.
Well, I am reminded of, about a person who I know was not a scientist. And that was the Apostle Paul. And he was quite implicit, as you read the writings of the Apostle Paul. This information that he got was not from me. No man taught it me. Now, the religionist will tell you that he was getting some sort of revelation from God, but as you look very closely at what Paul was saying, is that where he was getting, or was he actually having a psychic experience that allowed him to touch information that was unavailable to him otherwise?
You know, it's interesting. The church is opening up much more to psychic experience, certainly toward human potential. The Second Vatican Council has said that now they're beginning to feel that understanding human nature and understanding even these parts of it has a lot to do with understanding God, and that we can no longer just push that aside and say, that's from their religious point of view.
KABC Talk Radio 79.
And we'll get to that. You stand by.
May I see?
We not only want to open your mind, maybe we will stretch it a little bit. Massage it, sir. And maybe you'll learn how to use it a little bit more than you are right now. The mind is a wonderful thing. It's a fantastic tool. But it's there to serve you, not you it. And to help you with that particular idea, for whatever that might be worth to you, is Keith Arari. This is an encore appearance for Keith, and I love having him on. He's so energetic. Not only that, he's got his beautiful new bride with him tonight. You know, I understand why you married her, Keith. I don't understand why she married you. And Dr. Russell Tart, who has worked very closely with...
No,
Russell's not the one. Charles.
Russell is taller than me.
Russell's the other guy.
Hair.
He's the one with the funny hair, you know, that is here. Who I always associate with Keith because, you know, I've had them on a couple of times and they're two of my favorite people. And I certainly enjoy the the work that they have done. Charles Tart. Charles, I love your letter, The Open Mind. That's good. How does someone go around getting this newsletter?
Anyone interested in getting
information? You didn't ask me if you could use that name, by the way.
Oh, you'll
I
be real.
Permission.
Okay. Anyone interested in information on The Open Mind can write me at the psychology department, the University of California, Davis, in Davis, California, and I'll be happy to send them information.
You know what I love about it, Charles? And you were reading my mind when you put this together. In the front of it is a definition of what the open mind is and what a closed mind is. Would you be so kind as to go through that litany?
Sure. The open mind's curious about all sorts of things. It has an intelligence confidence in itself based on self-knowledge of its strengths and weaknesses. It wonders what's beyond and behind the everyday world. It enjoys using its powers and testing its limits and adding knowledge and skills. And the open mind can take intelligent and calculated risks for the sake of growth, not foolish ones, but calculated ones. The open mind cultivates sensible doubts and grows from them. It realistically recognizes current weaknesses and limits, but seeks to grow beyond them. And particularly, the open mind appreciates living in a marvelous and mysterious universe. Now, the closed mind, on the other hand, is a drag.
Yeah,
I mean, this list is sort of the opposite of that. The closed mind is dulled by habit and fantasy, running in the same grooves over and over again. The closed mind vacillates between feeling insecure or unrealistically confident based on illusions about itself and a stifling of self-knowledge. The closed mind guards and reinforces the borders of the everyday world. It doesn't want any change. Tries to protect them. The open mind uses its powers to defend its current reality and fears to test the limits. Did I say the open mind?
You said the open mind.
I meant the closed mind. The closed mind avoids risks or takes foolish ones through lack of self-understanding. The closed mind avoids doubts by mental rigidity or poisons itself by useless doubts. The closed mind denies weaknesses and limits or takes them as absolute and unchangeable. And the closed mind wants only knowledge that's pleasant. I try to stimulate the open mind in this newsletter. I write about parapsychological things, about spiritual growth and psychological growth techniques, and I try to shake people up a little bit to remind them of what our possibilities might be. Not as dogma. You know, I don't have anything that I want to say, this is the truth, you better believe it. But from my research in this area, I see interesting things happen that keep reminding us that, wow, this mind of ours is incredible, the things we may be able to do. And if you keep yourself reminded of those things, maybe you'll try them. Maybe you'll grow. And maybe it'll be more pleasant that way.
You wouldn't mind if I put this in a frame, your open mind, closed mind thing, and stick them in my office, would you?
I'd be overwhelmed and honored, Bill.
Well, I'm flattered at what you were saying, and I am encouraged by what you were saying. Because that is, although you put it down in a litany that is far more expressive than I'm able to do, but it certainly does say what we're about here on this show. And to find that others are thinking that way, and of course, I know they are, but in such a fine poetic way, I'm thrilled. So I want to keep that.
Okay.
Stick it on a wall. And send it to anybody who wants it.
Maybe even read the material, too.
I certainly read the material. I'm getting to where I can just read like you wouldn't believe. I really have to. The world is moving so very, very incredibly fast.
And you have to keep your mind open to deal with it. If you get a closed mind, what you really try to do is make the world stop changing. And you know, that's pretty hard to do. So it's very frustrating to close your mind and try to make the world sit still. It won't happen.
Well, have you noticed that the world is moving at a different tempo now? Of course, we deal with many things other than the so-called, quote, psychic phenomena or human potential. That's really where I look at that. But in the world of science and philosophy, all of these things are coming together at an enormous rate. Now, you and I were having a conversation about the relationship between the spiritual being and the physical being. And we've had many conversations here about, in the world of science, this is also happening. The great physicist of our time, and I'm very honored to have a chance to have an intimate relation with many of them. who were the agnostics, or just the non-spiritual persons altogether, who had become very spiritual, not necessarily religious, but very spiritual in their approach to life, because now they're seeing the physics and dynamics of spirituality and the power of the human spirit being displayed in front of them in their laboratory.
You know, the growth of science in our culture, I think, was necessary because organized religion had become an establishment. A lot of nonsense was in there. Our culture needed to say, we're going to look at everything anew. We're going to throw that out. But I think we've discovered psychologically, you can't totally throw out the spiritual. What you have to do now that we have more of a scientific solidity is come back and find out what's real in the spiritual realm, what isn't. To give you an example, all the great spiritual traditions tell us that we're all one. Well, yeah, that's a great idea, we're all one. But I like to ask people, do you feel at all one with me or that guy over there or anybody else? And the reality is we don't usually feel like we're one with other people. We feel encapsulated inside our skin. And modern science seems to tell us that's the truth. We're all inside our brains. If that's true, that leads to a lot of selfish feelings. That leads to feelings of isolation. You know, if you're separate from me, what do I care if you suffer? I don't feel it directly. But now along comes something like telepathy that says, hey, wait a minute. Once in a while, at least, and maybe more often than we think, there's a really intimate connection between you and me. There's a real mind-to-mind joining. Maybe that idea that we're all one is not just some abstract philosophy. Maybe that's talking about a reality, and if that's part of the reality of who we are, I think I'd better find out more about it. Because, you know, if you and I and other people are one, your suffering isn't isolated. Your suffering's my suffering. I'm going to care in a much more intimate way about that. That's why I said earlier I'm really concerned about the implications, because we live in a world where kind of physicalism or materialism has despirited us very badly, where we think when we die, that's the end. When we're alive, we're isolated. Our horizons are very limited. And then out of science itself, in a strange way, in the science of parapsychology, comes this new scientific stuff that says, wait a minute, you can't limit human beings like this. There are things like telepathy, and we really are connected. Let's find out about that. That, to me, is what's exciting, applying that.
You know, there's some other exciting aspects of it, Charles and Keith, that I have noticed, not only in the world of science and parapsychology, where we would do it, but in the world of business, which I have an opportunity to deal with. The very serious people in business who are moving into the frontiers of the providing of goods and services for us, which is what business is basically all about, realize that what we have been doing in the past is wrong. It's not working. As you look, you see the great financial institutions of our time are beginning to break down. They have to merge or they're going bankrupt. Why? And one of the reasons is that we have taken a very, very wrong approach, a non-spiritual approach. One of the building blocks, for instance, of capitalism, as we have been taught from the time we were children, which is an untrue building block, and it was never intended to be a part of capitalism, that is, for instance, I have this good that I want to serve you here, and I will charge you what the market will bear, and that is good business.
And if you and I are totally separate, why not? What do I care if you feel
that? That's right, but actually, whenever you analyze that particular thing, particularly if what you have is new or it's rare, you can't escape from the fact that charging what the market will bear is a form of greed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there is certainly a level that you should charge for this based upon what your costs were and to make a normal profit. But to charge what the market will bear is greed. And greed destroys men and societies and nations. And these businessmen are looking at the very rudimentary elements of the way we do business in the United States and the world over, and they will tell me that we are no longer a profit-motivated society, but we are a greed-motivated society, and there is a profound difference, and the one who is going to be destroyed the most by that is us as a society, and they are changing those spots.
There's a wonderful Buddhist term that sums up the problem. It's the term of what is right livelihood. How do you earn a living in a way that's fair to other people, that doesn't harm other people.
Mm-hmm.
And our psychology, our sociology, our science really has to be applied to that. You said it very well. We're driven by greed. No matter how much you have to have more and more and more. And, well, of course, we're destroying our world that way.
One of the reasons for that is that people feel so isolated. They feel so separated in their own minds. So alone.
Mm-hmm.
So in need of personal fulfillment. And so at a loss for answers, even the right questions. That getting that next product, getting that next thing, grabbing onto something. I want a new car. I want a bigger house. I want something else.
I want to get that contract.
I want to get that contract. I want to get that person. The whole idea is to sort of reaching out for more to get your answers, to fulfill you, to go on to the next thing, the so-called yuppies, get the next possession.
Whatever it is.
Whatever it is. And let's change the fashion quickly enough so that you'll want the next trend. And you keep yourself running after trends, and while you're running after those trends, you're never looking back and saying, gee, the last one wasn't really very fulfilling. It didn't really make me feel good about myself or anything else. Oh, but I got to keep up with the next trend. There's no time to really think about that.
I need a bigger size TV screen in order to be, you know, in vogue or whatever it is.
And that isn't working for people.
No.
What you find is that we don't live in a me-first universe. We live in an information universe. We are connected on some level. It is, in a way, too much for people to handle sometimes. All of the information that's floating out there, you tend to feel even smaller and more alienated, more alone. The computer revolution, this revolution, that information. God, what about politics? What about the meaning of life? How about making a buck? How about love and romance? How about the whole world? How about reading the newspaper? People don't even read the newspaper anymore, a lot of them. And the idea is not really a reaching out, it's to empower people. When people begin to realize that, in fact, there is a whole other level of their being, there is a level, you can call it the psychic, a kind of connectedness, an ability to relate to the world in a less analytic way on some level. It's not that you throw out the analysis, it's that there is something in addition to that, some way of relating to the world that makes you not quite as alone, not quite as isolated, and that in some sense there's a kind of fulfillment of your own potential. And I'm not saying, and therefore this is the answer to humanity. I'm saying that we need to learn to look at our own capabilities and who we are as people and stop looking to things to fulfill us outside of ourselves.
I'd like to apply that very specifically with what we've been talking about. If we take the view that we're nothing but our body and brain, then all we have is what's physical. So my happiness depends on getting physical things. And then, of course, your happiness depends on getting physical things. Well, suppose there's not enough physical things to go around. Well, then if you have them and I don't, I'm unhappy. And we have wars and so forth. But suppose we're really connected. Suppose we really come to know in some direct sense that we're connected. Well, then if you have something, I'm very happy. Because if you have it, we all have it. We can switch the whole basis of what makes happiness in life, this whole competitive greed thing, if we really come to understand the kind of real connections there are between us and share our happiness that way.
You touched upon a very key word that is happening, or that is changing, let's say. Let's, in our business community, and this is a very, I call it our system of providing goods and services. That's the way we all survive doing that. The word was competitive. Now, it's one thing to be competitive if you're out in the jungle, but it's another thing to use that same competition if you're in the jungle of the high rises of downtown Los Angeles and have the very same attitudes where you win and the other guy loses, and the fact that his wife and children won't have any food or anything because you got the deal and he didn't, and too bad about him. And
I'd like to look at that concept of winning by getting the stuff,
right,
and the other guy losing, and where that's getting us. Did you see the cover of Newsweek a few weeks ago?
Well, there are a lot of people competing for the same thing, and there's only going to be one winner under that, so we have mostly losers then, don't we?
What we have is a tremendous, tremendous drug problem.
Mm-hmm.
And what is that about? People trying to make themselves feel good people searching for some kind of inner experience. And these are not just people lying in some alley someplace on the skid row, but these are
some of our listeners,
professional people, everyday people on the street.
Right.
The drug problem is so vast. As a psychologist, it really makes me wonder what is missing in our everyday lives
to cause us to go that way.
To cause us to go that way, to try to find an inner experience, something special, some either just relief from everyday life or some search for some kind of inner sensation that isn't being fulfilled in some other way. And why do that? Why not?
And particularly when they know it's self-destructive.
Well, maybe that's the idea.
And right, that's the reason I said that. I mean,
but our physicalistic material culture is inherently destructive because, look, if we're nothing but our bodies and brains, there's one conclusion you can't escape, and that is that you're going to die. Mm-hmm. So since you're going to die, you better try and get your pleasures as much as you can now, and the devil take the hindermost. I'm afraid that comes out of this whole attitude, which is why we need a spiritual reawakening. But we can't have it the old way. We can't just suddenly say, okay, we'll believe something because it's called spiritual.
See, whenever we say spiritual, Charles, all at once people think in terms of religion and ritual and ceremony and rote.
And it scares them away because they say, who needs all that? That wasn't working for me either.
Well, I think inwardly most people, not all, but most people recognize that that doesn't do it.
Right. And I'm deliberately using the word spiritual instead of religion because I want to get away from
organized
religion.
There is a profound difference.
There's a reality behind all those things that later became organized religions, but we mustn't confuse the inner reality with the outer forms, or then we get caught in the errors of the
past. I think, you know, religions are going through the problem right now of there's nothing the matter with the religions, but there's a great deal of matter of what man has done to them.
It's interesting to look at what the major religions have said and to synthesize all of that down. And Damien Simpson, who a lot of your listeners may know, has a place where he has all of these listed.
Mm-hmm.
Love your neighbor, treat another person as you would treat yourself. And it's all different religions. They all say the same thing. Well, why are they killing one another?
Well, we know that religions are not working too well at this point in time. As we sit here right now, gentlemen, there are 38 wars being fought on the face of this planet, and man's inhumanity to man has never been at a greater level than it is at this moment. And it's not just on those battlefields. It's also right here in downtown Los Angeles in those shining towers down there.
Absolutely.
I'll share with you one of the reasons most religions aren't working, and this comes out of my investigation of altered states of consciousness over the years. The truth that lies behind religions, the spiritual truth, usually is only apprehended in some kind of altered state of consciousness, not in your normal state. If you get a religion that's lost the techniques for teaching people how to meditate, how to go inward, and instead just says, this is the doctrine and you better believe this or else, you get a religion that doesn't go to the core of people. And so naturally it doesn't work. That's why we're so interested in Eastern religions now, for instance, because they come with methods. They come with something to do. They tell you, in a sense, how to be spiritual and good instead of just that you ought to be spiritual and good. And this is one of the great hopes of our times, I think.
They at least taught you how to meditate, but the Christian religion was also teaching you how to meditate. They just couched it in different language.
Well, if you get caught up in the ritual...
They lost the practice, though.
But they lost the practice.
If you get caught up in the ritual and the dogma, you must do this, you must light this candle three ways, do the ceremony, and you've emptied that of the experience, and you've really lost something, and you're just sort of walking in military fashion into the church, and what we need is a sense of the experience that doesn't come from drugs.
Well, you see, what
doesn't come from some...
What has happened here, Keith, by doing the ceremony and doing the ritual and doing the rote, we have done something else that most people like to do. We have relieved ourselves of the obligation of responsibility and order.
And we've emptied ourselves of the experience.
And therefore, we don't have to do anything. We can wear our little caps and we can play with our beads, and there we have done our good thing for the day, and we can go back being the primitive person that we were. But in our mind, we can say, hey, we've done all of the things. We went to church, but we did this, we did a bunch of stuff.
Originally, the ritual was about creating an experience.
That's right. It was a focusing point.
It was a focusing point. And when people begin to work with their own capabilities again, with that side of their open minds, which is, let's say, intuitive, which is that part that we tend to deny in that hard analytic world that we live in, we get into that other side of ourselves, that's a very special thing. And you can do that without following some doctrine, some dogma. So looking at your own experience, opening up to that and its possibilities for you without having me or anyone else sit here and tell you what to make of reality. Opening up the experience is in itself a dramatic change. And people will decide what that means for them. And it's available to people in a very specific way. It's not something that we're talking about purely in the abstract. We have good scientific data showing that, in fact, everyday ordinary people, even a bunch of people who get together in a room for a workshop just to work on looking at certain parts of their own experience, not having a religious thing laid on them, but just, here, let's work on learning how to use these abilities. Those kinds of people, all of us, can, in fact, develop their intuitive abilities, and by doing that, have a very special experience of themselves. It's empowering. We have enough power being taken away from us by the society at large, by all the confusion, by everything that we don't understand. We don't need to have psychic abilities, yet another area in which somebody else excels and I'm powerless. That's terrible. But in fact, it's not that way at all. In fact, people have this available to them in a very straightforward way, and that's the surprising thing in the research. And the implications of that are really tremendous for our understanding of human nature.
I like the way this conversation has gone, gentlemen. I really do. We've spent a little more time away from our audience than I usually do, but there are some inner ramifications about the importance of the scientific work that you're doing. Let's put one foot in reality, if we can, and another foot on this mystic thing we call spirituality, and keep them together. And we have done that, and I want to get to the audience. Are you ready to talk to them out there? They're just lined up right here like crazy, ready to talk to each and every one of you. And let me give you the numbers. We're just started, and we're going to talk to Al. Al, welcome aboard.
Thank you, Bill. Welcome aboard, Charles and Keith. One little thing that helps me to get rid of the mental and physical confusions in society is a little buzzword I call MSP, meaning mental, spiritual, and physical. And, of course, the spiritual is lacking in all of us, and that helps me to keep on track. But the reason why I'm calling is we do a lot of practice with Rhine cards and remote viewing, and we have very good success. And I kind of feel...
Did you identify we?
Some of my employees, Bill, I also wanted to say that we're a local company that believes in giving to society first rather than taking and bumping up prices and so on.
You get five stars.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
Find out you'll be more successful because the guys that are trying to take instead of give are going to have to compete with your givers and they will lose.
That's right. Giving is what God wanted us to do, and I don't feel I'm religious, but... I do know that it comes back tenfold.
Sure feels better, doesn't it?
It sure does. And from our testing, Charles and Keith, I come to a theory that I really don't think there is any time. I think that this is an illusion just as the separation of individuals. What is your feeling on that with the experiments in the lab?
Well, clearly our understanding of our relationship with space and time is totally incomplete. When people can describe in very, very accurate detail something that will happen to them or to some other person in the future, even miles and miles away, there's no way that they could have known that information. That really throws some real confusion into what we thought we knew about time. We thought that the future hadn't happened yet, and there is no way to get information about something that hasn't happened, theoretically. And yet you see people describing time and time again in the laboratory events that seemingly haven't occurred. Now, what does that mean?
Right.
Does it mean that...
Oh, it's a very simple thing.
Oh, it's a very simple thing. Well, does it mean that somehow or other something very strange happened there in nature? I don't think so. I think what happened there is that we don't see things the way they are. And occasionally, the way they are kind of peeks through into our experience. Nothing strange happened there in nature. It's just that we don't always see it the way it is.
Well, I say simple, that's not true. It's a natural thing.
Right. <All right. laughs> that's
be natural.
Because it isn't simple.
That explains it.
That explains it. But there's a thing, Al, known as the space-time continuum that the physicists are working with all of the time. And we have found that we can, indeed, in physics, break down or alter that space-time continuum.
Exactly. It's like the clock that man has made for us, the recent clock. But what happened with the Aztec people? And they were able to manage, and they had a different way of time.
You know, I love clocks. I collect them. I love clocks because, for me, they are one of the ultimate symbols
of man's biggest mistake.
Of man's confusion.
Exactly.
Well, now let me put in a good word for clocks here. Clocks are real handy for getting to your next appointment.
Absolutely.
Clocks represent a certain kind of psychological time that works very well for a lot of ordinary physical processes. But Keith put his finger on it, Al, you know. We don't really understand time. This precognition stuff in ESP is the big reminder that we don't know anything about time. The mind can reach into the future sometime. We have no way of understanding that at present, so it should serve to remind us a little bit of how little we know, keep us humble and open-minded to look for it.
Now, I'll tell you something that I've never told anybody before, but we've been experimenting with a device that breaks down the space-time continuum. And one of the...